Well, what we wanted to do with this briefing was to lend some perspective on why things are developing as they are in the Middle East. And as I travel, one of the most frequent questions I get is, why is it that we watch so intently the Middle East? And there's probably three main reasons for that. The first is the central role of Israel in God's plan. Most people may not realize that 5/6 of the Bible is all about Israel, from Genesis 12 to Acts 2 as a minimum, and much more than that. Even Revelation 12 is really a summary from Genesis 3:15 to the end. And the key point that we need as Christians, we need to understand is that God is not through with Israel. Tragically, many have been taught the contrary, but God has made irrevocable promises to Israel that have yet to be fulfilled. Paul, in his definitive statement of Christian doctrine called the Book of Romans, hammers away for three chapters, Romans 9, 10, and 11, that God is not finished with Israel. They have a very clear destiny. The entire history of Israel, their origins, their ups, their downs, and their destiny is all laid out in advance. And we need to remember that these irrevocable commitments in the Old Testament that God is yet to fulfill with Israel, he will. To deny that is really to make God a liar. And if you'd like more background on this, we encourage you to review our briefing package called The Prodigal Heirs, which deals with the distinctives between the church and Israel. They're really quite different. But in any case, Israel is the key to God's timeline, and that's one of the three reasons we watch the Middle East. A second reason is because of the prophecies in Ezekiel 38 and 39, where a major invasion of Israel is thwarted by the intervention of God himself. And this famous passage in Ezekiel 38 and 39, of course, is subject to some controversies. There are three basic views. Some, of course, assume that it's post-millennium from some remarks that are made in Revelation 20, verse 8. But I think most prophecy scholars believe that it is preceding to the millennium, the particular event that we're looking at there. Many, like Hal Lindsey and others, feel that this is part of the Armageddon sequence, as detailed in Daniel 11. Armageddon, of course, occurring at the end of this fabled seven-year period called the 70th week of Daniel. There are a number of us, and I lean this way, of course, that Grant Jeffries, Chuck Smith, and others hold, that this event in Ezekiel 38 and 39 probably occurs prior to the 70th week of Daniel. In other words, it could be on our near horizon. There are no particular intervening events that need to precede it. It could be on our horizon. So we watch the Middle East closely for that reason. There's a third reason that's not as widely held as some of the others, but still gets some comment, and that's Isaiah 17, verse 1, which speaks of the burden of Damascus. Behold, Damascus is taken away from being a city, and it shall be a ruinous heap. Well, Damascus never has been destroyed in those terms, and so many scholars feel that part of the end-time scenario will be the total destruction, the wipeout of the city of Damascus. And so that's another reason we watch closely as to what might be going on as we see the possibility of a nuclear exchange in that region. Well, the other thing we want to focus on is Jerusalem specifically, because in Zechariah, it points out that all the people of the earth will be gathered together against it, Zechariah 12. Well, if you study carefully the history here, it's really provocative. In May of 1948, it was the UN that declared that Israel would have a nation in the Holy Land. But today, in Israel, the Jewish people believe that they only have one true ally, namely the United States. What has changed? Why does it seem that the United Nations are against Israel and pro-Islam? The G8 leaders called on the Israeli government to allow foreign observers to monitor the ceasefire agreement. But Israel has been opposed to allowing the United Nations to act as observers and said that they might allow the U.S. to send more personnel to oversee the situation. Well, Israel has good reason to be skeptical of the U.N. History has shown that international observers have never been impartial towards Israel and have never protected a ceasefire agreement, but have rather protected the Palestinian ability to violate it. Thus, the Israelis have no crashing desire to have the U.N. personnel running around. In 1949, there was a ceasefire armistice agreement. The United Nations military observers were deployed along the ceasefire lines between Syria, Jordan, and Egypt. And between 1949 and the Six-Day War of 1967, that's a period of 18 years, there were thousands of attacks into Israel from behind Egyptian, Syrian, and Jordanian lines. Not one of these attacks produced a single condemnation by the United Nations, which was, they were supposed to be policing the ceasefire lines. However, the UN observers complained faithfully whenever Israel responded to these attacks. More recently, the UN Observer Force in Lebanon, the UNIFIL, was deployed along the militarized area in southern Lebanon, while Israel battled the Hezbollah, which operated out of Lebanon, and the pattern was the same. The Hezbollah would launch artillery attacks across the border, and UNIFIL would protest against the Israeli response to those attacks. During the Camp David Accords recently, that is during the Clinton administration, Prime Minister Ehud Barak offered more than any other prime minister of Israel ever had, but it was not enough to appease Yasser Arafat. Barak conceded to over 90% of the demands made by the PLO, and yet no common ground could be reached. And as a result, the message was clear. The message was that there would be no peace in the Middle East. And if you study the history of the conflict, you will discover, as Abba Ibn so eloquently summarized it, that the Arabs never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. The following election in Israel, of course, gave us a clear indication of the mood of the Israeli people. They elected a man that was a war hero and a public enemy number one to the PLO. And so now there is a clear doctrine of peace through strength in Israel, a position that the people of Israel were reluctant to take, but through the breakdown of the Camp David summit were forced into. If you have not been in Israel, it's going to be hard for you to understand what I'm about to say, so I shall call on a bit of our own history to try to demonstrate this point. Many of you probably have seen the movie 13 Days, and if you have not, I would highly recommend that you see it. It's about the Cuban Missile Crisis in the 60s. It happens I was with the Assistant Secretary of Defense, John Rubel, at the time, and I can tell you that the movie does an excellent job of capturing the subtleties of that very tense period. Russia was placing short and mid-range nuclear missiles in Cuba, bringing the entire continental United States under its theater of threat. The United States would be at the mercy of the Russian Confederation. We were able to maneuver out of the situation through some masterful brinksmanship, and the missiles were ultimately removed. But now I want you to imagine that the USSR had been teaching their children for over 40 years that the U.S. was the great Satan, and that only the complete annihilation of all Americans would bring an end to the violence. Add to that terrorist suicide bombings of our school buses and malls along with declared and written documents that state that the USSR will only rest when the great Satan of the United States is driven into the sea. The other factor we would have to deal with is the continual pressures from the international communities to give in to the USSR and allow nuclear missiles to remain in Cuba. At this point, you might start to have an understanding of what Prime Minister Barak was willing to put on the table. If accepted, the concession would have left all of the Israeli military and Air Force bases within range of their sworn enemies. Israel, as it stands today, is less than one-third the size of San Bernardino County in California. The peace agreement proposed at Camp David would have also put Israel in a position that would have forced them to use their only other deterrent against an invasion, a nuclear response. I should mention that as we speak, there are three submarines offshore, Israeli submarines, each carrying 8 cruise missiles that can be nuclear equipped as their form of deterrent. Yes, we are looking at a very, very tense situation, and it's very possible that the next confrontation will be nuclear. What we have here is a three-pronged attack on Israel. The first one, of course, is the terrorist bombing of women and children. When we were in Israel a few years ago, a suicide bomber had blown himself up in a mall during the Israeli equivalent of our Halloween, and he was surrounded by hundreds of children. Many of these cases, the family of the terrorist is compensated to the tune of $100,000. Now, Israel's policy is, of course, to retaliate, hitting the specific terrorist leadership. I want you to always notice the surgical precision of the Israeli retaliation. In this case, they hit just recently 3 of the major leaders of the Hamas as they retaliated from a terrorist attack. As we go to press just now, a suicide bomber at a pizza parlor killed 18 and injured another 100. Another unexploded second bomb was found in the same restaurant, which it had failed to go off. Both the Hamas and the Islamic Jihad are fighting over who can take credit for this outrage. Now, it's interesting to remember that the Israelis target their military adversaries. The terrorists target innocent civilians. You know, there's a basic asymmetry here. Israel's enemies can attack through deniable rogue groups. In response, Israel has to stand accountable for its defensive measures. Something else to remember when you're traveling. I travel a lot, and I'm very conscious of this. Every time you go through an airport, you have to go through these special barricades where they search with electronics or what have you. Remember that when you are searched going through an airport, it isn't an Israeli bomb they're searching for. Israel doesn't deal in terrorism. Their adversaries do. A second form of attack on Israel is this charade we call the peace process. The first problem with the so-called peace process is that it is based on a false premise. It's based on the idea that reducing the borders of Israel will bring peace to the Middle East. The Arabs have made it abundantly clear from the beginning in their charters, in their speeches, and both before and during and since the Oslo Accord, that their intractable objective is not the size of Israel. It is the existence of Israel. They are insisting on what Israel cannot yield. And one of the things you must not forget is that Israel has never gone on the offensive in any of the military conflicts in the Middle East. All the disputed land that is now under the control of Israel was the result of an unprovoked attack against Israel, and that land is essential to the security of the entire nation. Think of it this way. Suppose you own a ranch in a valley, and to the east are foothills that overlook your homestead. On those hills, you have a neighbor who is your mortal enemy. He is continually proclaiming his hatred of you and his plans to slaughter your entire family. He starts by attacking your livestock, killing your cows, chickens, and burning down your barn. He does all of this from his perch high above your house. This goes on for 15 years, and one day your adversary comes down from the hill, walks into your living room, and kills one of your children. In response, you chase him over the hills and into the adjacent valley. He now proceeds to call town meetings, demanding that you get off his land. You say, fine, but I want you to take down the signs and stop handing out all the leaflets stating that you're going to kill my family and take over my ranch. He refuses, and at the same time he is buying shoulder-held rockets so he can destroy your house from the hilltop. He is asking you to give back to him. So you are faced with a decision. Do you give back this property, which, by the way, belonged to your great-great-grandfather before the ancestors of your neighbor killed him and took it by force? Or do you wait and see if you can truly obtain peace by giving this land back? So you wait, and while you wait, your neighbor kills more of your cows and chickens and also tries to murder more of your family members. So what do you do? Well, now this leads to a third form of attack, which I'll call the media war. Your neighbor has some allies in the local paper, we'll call it the Town Crier, and convinces them to publish a series of articles designed to paint you as the bad guy and him as the victim. You know that most of the people in the community know what really happened and do not think that anyone will believe the lies that are being told in the paper. But what you have not counted on is that this media bombardment will continue for years, and that the surrounding communities that do not know what really happened will come to the defense of your neighbor. At this point, years have passed, the media war continues, and even some people in your community begin to be duped by the false stories. You are being pressured from all sides, and your children are being attacked at school. At this point, you set up a meeting with the city council and your neighbor and offer to give back all the land except 10%, the 10% where your family is buried, but the deal is turned down. While you are at the meeting, you learn that your neighbor is smuggling illegal weapons into the compound that are capable of destroying your entire ranch from the hilltop. You report at the local paper and give them the picture, but obviously, no one cares. As the terrorist attacks continue against the citizens of Israel, the not-so-secret media war rages on. One dramatic example of this war was a photo run by the Associated Press and an accompanying report. The picture was reportedly of an Israeli soldier beating up a peaceful Palestinian. The problem is that when the picture was run in the U.S., a man in Chicago recognized the victim as his own son, who was a medical student in Israel, and he was being saved by the Israeli soldier from an attack by some Arabs. The other problem with the picture is that it reportedly was supposed to be all taking place on the Temple Mount, but there's a gas station in the background. Anyone that's visited Israel knows there's no gas stations on the Temple Mount. How could a mistake like this be made? If it was a scattered incident, it could happen as an accident, but it's a symptomatic of a pattern. On the UN front, there have even been reports that there's going to be war crime charges contrived against Prime Minister Sharon. So what we're dealing here, of course, is a legacy of hate. The Palestinian terrorist group, Islamic Jihad, is teaching teenage boys that becoming a suicide bomber attacking Israel will send them directly to paradise and that 70 virgins will be there to greet them. A BBC News report quotes one of the teachers, Islamic Jihad member Mohammed al-Hattab, as saying, quote, "We are teaching the children that suicide bombing is the only thing that make the Israeli people very frightened. Furthermore, we are teaching them that we have the right to do it," close quote. This legacy of hate will not subside until the Palestinians change the textbooks and school materials that continually teach their smallest children to hate the Jews. It's a legacy that continues generation after generation. Well, meanwhile, we now are watching serious war clouds once again on the horizon. Saddam Hussein is again moving his six divisions westward. It could very well result in a replay of the brinksmanship of last February 22nd of this year, when we were apparently only 10 minutes away from vaporizing Baghdad and Damascus with nuclear weapons. And, of course, the Isaiah 17 passage comes to mind. We talked about Ezekiel 38, and as most of us that watch it closely realize that one of the key players against Israel in that portrayal by Ezekiel is what we call today Turkey. Well, today Turkey has been pro-Israel. They have signed 16 mutual defense pacts with Israel because it's in their mutual interest to do so. But the tide is changing. NATO has been expelled from Turkey last week. Although Israel and Turkey jointly are abused by the European Union and that drives them together, it turns out that this is starting to change. Turkish Prime Minister Bülent Ecevit just recently has issued a scathing attack on Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's policy of refusing to negotiate under fire, which may signal a chill emerging in their relations with Israel. Sharon responded that he is willing to begin negotiations, but that a complete halt to violence, terror, and incitement must be a precondition. He said that the future depends on Palestinian Authority Chairman Yasser Arafat. Quote, "Nearly 50% of the terror comes from groups controlled by Arafat," Sharon said. "Arafat must choose whether he wants to be a head of state or a head of a gang of murderers." Sharon said that if 145 Israeli deaths from terror attacks were calculated in proportion to the population of Turkey, the figure would be more like 1,500 deaths. No democracy would tolerate such a thing, not Israel, not the United States, and certainly not Turkey, Sharon said. As the violence against Israel continues, another emerging specter has been added to the anti-Semitic attacks. It is cloaked in diplomacy and is rearing its militant head in countries around the world. The invasion of Islam into the Western cultures, including our own. Over the past 25 years, Muslims have found their way into positions of power throughout Europe by their sheer numbers. As a result, the Israeli delegate has found himself in an adversarial position in the UN and has even thought that they will contrive charges brought against Prime Minister Sharon. Even here in the U.S., the question is how long the United States will stand alone in the face of the UN charges. If you want more background on modern-day Israel, we encourage you to review our briefing package called The Betrayal of the Chosen. And it's taken from a number of the major definitive texts in this area, and you will find it extremely provocative and relevant to really understanding today's news. But one way for us to gain a background from an Israeli perspective is from a speaker that we've invited to join us in this discussion, Avi Lipkin. Avi studied for an MA in Israel's Conservative Jewish Seminary. He's been a spokesman for the Israeli Defense Force, formerly associated with the Institute for Western Defense in Jerusalem. He's the former senior editor and translator for the Israeli government press office under Prime Minister Shamir. He grew up in the U.S., but has spent over 18 years in Israel. His first book is titled, "Is Fanatic Islam a Global Threat?" In this book, Avi presents his belief that Christians and Jews must forge an alliance to stop Islam's secret goal to destroy Judaism and Christianity and dominate the world. Many Christians, by the way, especially in the U.S., have no perception of the real agenda of Islam. They know it's anti-Israel for a variety of reasons, but they don't realize that Christianity is part of the target also, very explicitly. Avi's second book, released in late 1999, is called Christian Revival for Israel's Survival. And for the last several years, of course, Avi has traveled extensively throughout the United States, speaking to groups of every size and denomination. Of all the contacts that we've had the privilege of sharing platforms with, Avi is well-informed, a close friend, and I hope you find him enlightening and provocative.
Thank you very much. I'm extremely, extremely pleased and extremely honored to be here today. Last time I was here was 3 years ago. I don't know how many of you remember, my son Jacob was with me. And by the way, Jacob is getting married on August 20th in Jerusalem. And today, I was in Pocatello with Pastor Lou Phelps, the Calvary Chapel there. I don't know how many of you know the Calvary Chapel there. And so Jacob was with me there, and we watched one of these international soccer games in Butte, Montana, on the way here. And so Jacob remembers those three places very well, and he remembers all of you. And actually, today marks my turning around and driving back to New York, because I've been on the road 2.5 months, starting in New York, Chicago, Beloit, Kansas City, Oklahoma City, Texas, Arizona, California, Oregon, Bend, Oregon, Twin Falls, Pocatello, and last night Boise, and here I am tonight. Tomorrow I'm in the church somewhere in Montana. I don't know yet where. I'll get the information, and God willing, in a few weeks I'll be going back to the Middle East with a stop in Greece. And I don't know where to start, because it's very hard to cram 9 hours into an hour and a half. We want to do half hour, I understand, of questions and answers. And of course, I can stay later to visit with all of you if you want. What I wanted to do was to focus this evening on two subjects. One subject is the war, unfortunately, that I feel is inevitable in the Middle East. And the second subject is the war that I feel is inevitable on American soil. And how many people here have seen the movie Jihad in America, PBS video by Steven Emerson? One hand, two hands, three, four, five. Okay, this is a video. I have to apologize. I ran out of them in Pocatello on Sunday. It's a PBS video which was made and then buried by PBS. Steven Emerson is an anti-terrorism reporter. He made this video together with the help of the FBI, the State Department, the CIA, the good guys in those organizations, and there are good guys in those organizations too. And because there were so many protests from the Islamic side, PBS buried the video, and PBS today will not even sell it over its 800 number. You have to buy it directly from Washington, D.C., from Steven Emerson. So for those who are interested, afterwards I will be glad to give you the telephone number, the 202 number. The video is a must, because it is truer and scarier today than when it first came out 8 years ago. It's a very prophetic video, and the video says, when there will be a war in the Middle East, yes, there will be a war front scenario on American soil as well. By the way, I wanted to recommend to all of you also, of course, after you get my two books, there's a third book I recommend very highly. It is not a Jewish book. It is not a Christian book. It is a Harvard University textbook written by Professor Samuel Huntington. The book is called The Clash of Civilizations and the Remaking of World Order. It's available in any good bookstore. It's a must read. It's an academic book. It's not easy reading, but it's a must read, because what Professor Huntington is saying is that forget about war in the Middle East right at this very moment. Within 50 years, the way things are going, America will be eclipsed. America will lose its preeminence. Judeo-Christian Western civilization will sink into oblivion, and you will have three pagan systems rivaling Judeo-Christian West. You have Mandarin China, you have Hindu India, and you have Islam. These are three pagan Eastern systems. They have the population, they have the money, they have the numbers, they have the power, they have the modernization. These are civilizations that are modernizing, but they will not westernize, because westernized means Judeo-Christian. This is a civilization war. This is not a war between countries. It's very important for all Christians. I want to say Christians and Jews, but Jews really don't count in this sense, because the Jews are very small in numbers. This is a struggle for the direction of the planet Earth in the next 50 years, if we're all still around. So it's very important for you to get that book as well. I focus in my message on Islam, because the Chinese and the Hindus don't necessarily say, kill the Jew on Saturday, kill the Christian on Sunday. The Muslims do. The Muslim motto is, kill the Jews on Saturday, because they're the people of the Saturday, kill the Christians on Sunday, because they are the people of the Sunday. And, you know, I dare any Muslim to debate with me and say that this is not true. This is the bottom line of Islam. How do I know? My wife is a woman who was born in Egypt. She was raised in Egypt, just as I was born in America, raised in America. We both met in Jerusalem. We're both Jewish, but it's like an American marrying an Arab. And my wife for 30 years is pointing her finger at me and saying, you Americans just cannot understand what the Islamic mindset is all about. For 30 years she's saying it, and after 30 years it begins to sink in. I say in a slightly different way. It takes a thief to know a thief. And you guys are incapable of understanding thieves because you're not thieves. But I am a thief because I come from the Middle East after 33 years. I come back to America to warn you about the things that I have seen in 33 years and which you Americans are only now beginning to see in different ways. By the way, my wife Rachel also works for her living, working for the Israeli radio. She, of course, since her Arabic is her mother tongue, she listens to the Arabic language radio broadcasts of our neighbors, including the Hezbollah in Lebanon, the Saudis, the Palestinian radio stations, the Syrians. And let me tell you something. You really, really need to pray for my wife, Rachel, because she comes home sick every night listening to 7.5 hours of the venom, the vitriolic venom of Islam, where they say, kill the Jew, kill the Christian, kill the Israeli, kill the American, in the same breath. And what I want to do tonight, this is almost like Mission Impossible. When I teach my 9-hour seminars as I travel across the country, I do 3 hours on the Bible versus the Quran, Judeo-Christianity versus Islam. 3 hours. If you don't understand the Bible, and if you don't understand the Quran, if you don't understand the roots, the religious roots of the conflict, then you don't understand what is happening in the Middle East, and you cannot understand what is about to happen on American soil. The second session of 3 hours deals with terrorism. And unfortunately, Americans are lulled asleep by the media. The American people are desensitized because the agenda in Washington has decided that a little information, a little knowledge can be dangerous. So you're not supposed to get any information. And frankly, I'm past getting upset. But the news that you hear, the opening news for the last few weeks, has been Chandra Levy, the intern, and the politician Condit. And I don't know who's guilty, I don't know who's not guilty, I don't know what happened to her, I hope she's okay, she probably isn't, but the point I'm saying is this is not news. This is a placebo. And I'm going to get back to that in a moment. I want to finish. The third session that I do is on Israel and the inevitable war that's coming in the Middle East. So it's 9 hours of teaching and 9 hours of reading in my two books. And there's a lot of military information there from Israel, a lot of current events and private investigation that I have done here on American soil as well, involving Islamic infiltration into the country. What I will do indeed, I will just give you a few words of the methodology of how I develop this work that I'm doing now. And suffice it to say, I started in 1990 speaking in America on the eve of Desert Storm. And since I was an Israeli army spokesman. I was retired July 4th a year ago. Then they recalled me September 28th when Arafat went crazy. So I don't know if I'm in the Israeli reserves still or not, but if, God forbid, there's a war, we all beg to be allowed to serve. I came here, made predictions about Saddam Hussein, which all came true, because not because I'm a prophet, because I'm not a prophet, but because I just had the information from the Israeli army, which trained me. I went back to Israel for the Desert Storm. We were hit by 39 Scuds. There was a miraculous time for us. Only one person died in Israel from 39 direct Scud hits. This is a miracle from God. And nobody should have died. But the wife begged her husband to go into the air raid shelter, and his answer was, it'll never happen to me. So we need to listen to our wives. By the way, I have to tell you something. I was once court-martialed by the Israeli army for saying very bad things about Hosni Mubarak, which are in my book, by the way. And when I came home, my wife said, so why did you say those things? And I said to her, well, because you said them, and you're Egyptian, and I listen to you, and you know what you're talking about. So my wife looks at me and says, so why do you listen to me? If I don't listen to her, you know, I'm damned. I'm damned if I do, I'm damned if I don't. And then from 1991 to 1994, I went to the Jewish Theological Seminary to try to become a rabbi. I did not succeed. I am not a rabbi, unless you consider me a rabbi to 20, 30 million Christians as I travel around the United States. And then in 1994, this is where I want to really start my message. I come to the United States, and I'm really flabbergasted because in Jerusalem, we had just gotten cable TV. And Israel is a very special place. Here you have 60 or 100 or 200 stations today. And you do find interesting things. When it was 30, 40, 50 stations, it was really all the, they were all the same stations. In Israel, it's different. In Israel, if you're a polyglot, if you speak many languages, you're in heaven in Jerusalem. We have four or five Arabic language stations from different countries. We have three Turkish stations, three Russian stations, three German stations, three French stations, two Italian stations. We have Spain. We have BBC, Sky TV. And, of course, we have CNN International, and we have ABC News. And when I was watching CNN and ABC News, there was this woman's face on the TV all the time. I put on Russian TV, you wouldn't see it, or German TV, or English TV, only on the American TV station. And this was, like, for weeks, this woman's face, she was in court. It was like live proceedings of a court trial. And I was trying to figure out what's so earth-shattering about this woman. And what was so earth-shattering was that this was Lorena Bobbitt. And this was 2 months. I got to the States, then there was another woman's face on the TV screen. There was no other news. It was just that woman's face. And that was Tanya Harding. Then in July of 94, you had O.J. Simpson. And that went on for 2 years. Then you had Monica Lewinsky. Then you had Elian Gonzalez. And now you have Chandra Levy. If you get my gist, this is a placebo. This is non-news. What you're getting from the media is entertainment, very sick entertainment. And what you're not being told is that America, Israel, the world is on the verge, I say, of a world war. We are very close. And Chuck Missler has been talking about this type of thing also many, many times. I come, from a Jewish and from an Israeli perspective. Nobody's talking about the fact that 2 million black brothers and sisters have been slaughtered in the Sudan, that 6 to 8 million are in the process of being slaughtered in the Sudan, and Omar Bashir, who is the general who runs Sudan, he's not a war criminal. But Slobodan Milosevic kills 2,000 Muslim terrorists, and he's in The Hague as a war criminal. By the way, Ariel Sharon is next, in case you didn't know. And I'm going to talk about that a little later, because the cards are stacked against us. They kill 300,000 Catholics on the island of East Timor in Indonesia. The Muslims do. Nobody says anything. Christians are being slaughtered, enslaved, persecuted more today than any other time in the last 2,000 years. By the way, when I was in Greece working to complete my third book on the parallels ethics, my Greek friends, born-again Christians, said to me, you know how many Greeks died in the 1920s? This is after World War I. There was a war with Turkey. Venizelos was the commander of the Greek army. 1 million Greeks, civilians, were slaughtered very much in the same way as 1,500,000 Armenians were slaughtered by the Turks. And when Hitler killed the 6 million Jews in World War II, he said, well, nobody said anything about the Turks killing the Armenians. So the point is this. Muslims can get away with killing millions and millions of Christians. We look at this in history. By the way, I was in Phoenix, Arizona. This is really funny. I spoke in the church, and the pastor had to run. And where are you staying tonight? I said, I just drove in from Texas. I don't know where I'm sleeping tonight. And there were two little nuns. They were Lutheran evangelical nuns. The Evangelical Sisterhood of Mary. They're based in Darmstadt, Germany. And they were at the church to hear me. And they said, would you like to come and stay with us, you know? And I spent 2 weeks in a Lutheran evangelical nunnery with 13 nuns. I fell in love with all of them. I called my wife. I said, I'm going to marry these 13 nuns. And my wife says, go for it, go for it. So, why was I telling you about the German nuns? Anyway, So I was in Phoenix, and this will come back. This is, I think, after 8 hours of driving, sometimes you lose your train of thought. I'll get to that in a moment. So the news media in this country are not telling you anything. They are filling up 60 Minutes. It's a program called 60 Minutes. They're filling it up 60 minutes of non-news. Yes, now I remember, when I was in Phoenix, there was a Christian woman, an Arab Christian woman. She is from the Assyrian Orthodox Church. And I knew that there was such a thing as Assyrian Christians. The Assyrian Christians, they're the oldest church in Christianity. They're the Church of Antioch. And she lived in a place called Zaho. Zaho is in the northwest of Iraq, where Turkey, Syria, and Iraq meet. There's a very big population of Assyrian Christians. And she said in the last 40 years, or 50 years, the Iraqi Muslims killed 3.5 million Assyrian Christians. So you have many, many genocides taking place in the world, and Christians and Jews equally are totally ignorant of what Islam has been doing in the last 100 years. Now, what I wanted to do was to look, I don't want this to sound too much as a university lecture, but this is basically what I've been doing over the last few months. I want to look globally at Islam from its very, very beginning. I want to take about, if I may, about 20 minutes, 30 minutes, because if you understand the background of Islam, you understand why these things are happening today. And what, if you know the past, you'll understand what the future is. You know what they're aiming at. What I do in my lectures, usually, on Islam, the first 3 hours, I give the 5 deceptions of Islam. And I'll do it very quickly, very telegraphically. Islam says 5 things. Islam is a religion of love. Islam is a religion of peace. Allah is just another name for God. Jesus Christ of the Muslims is the same Jesus Christ of the Christians. And, of course, the Quran is a holy book. These are the 5 deceptions of Islam. And I debunk them in every lecture that I give. The first deception that I debunk is that Islam is a religion of love. Now, when I read the New Testament for the first time, it was because in seminary, my teachers gave me 4 verses of the New Testament, Mark 12, 28 to 31. And Jesus is asked by the Pharisees, how do you like a Jew preaching Jesus? Jesus is asked by the Pharisees, what is the most important commandment of all? And Jesus says, Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one God. This is something that is the holy of holies for all Jews. Then he goes on. That's Deuteronomy 6, verse 4. Then Deuteronomy 6, verse 5, he continues, Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, with all thy mind, with all thy strength. That is the first commandment. The second commandment is like, namely this, Thou shalt love thy neighbor is thyself, which is Leviticus 19:18. And then Jesus, I think, says something absolutely fantastic and absolutely remarkable. In half a verse, he summarizes the whole Bible. There are no commandments greater than these two. Jesus summarizes the whole Bible, all 613 commandments, into two. Love the Lord thy God, love thy fellow as thyself. Do you know that these two commandments are not in the Quran? If you read the Quran, the book of Islam, the commandments to love are not there. The word love appears 27 times. Allah loves this, Allah loves that. But the commandments in the context of love the Lord thy God, love thy fellow as thyself, these are not in Islam. Now, Muslims are good people. They're loving people. You know why? Because Muslims are human beings. They are created in the image of God, just like the Jews, the Christians, and the Buddhists, and the Hindus. The problem is not the flesh. The problem is a spirit which is satanic and pagan. Muslims are loving people, but the Islamic religion is not. So I debunk the deception number one. Islam is not a religion of love. And I will give you one or two quotes in a few moments about that. Second deception, that Islam is a religion of peace. The Islamic religion divides the world into two. You have the Dar es Salaam, the house of peace, or the house of Islam, and you have the Dar al Harb, the house of war. The Dar es Salaam is the house of the Muslims. Anybody who's not a Muslim is the Dar al Harb, the house of war. And the Dar es Salaam cannot have peace on earth until the Dar al Harb is destroyed. In other words, until the pagans are gone, and the Jews and the Christians are gone, and the whole world has been Islamicized. This is cardinal in the Islamic religion. So, let's look at the utopia of Islam. In other words, the Dar es Salaam. Let's look at countries that are Islamic, and there are no other people, no non-believing people there. Afghanistan. Buddhists and Hindus are gone, except for a few thousand Hindus who have to wear a yellow badge, just like the Jews in the Holocaust. And the Jews and the Christians are gone. Afghanistan is a utopia. By the way, what does utopia mean in Greek? Eutopia. Eutopia in Greek means a place that cannot possibly exist. So Afghanistan is an Islamic utopia. Algeria, 100,000 Muslims have been slaughtered by their own fellow Muslims in the last 6-7 years. This is not a war against Jews and Christians. This is a war in which Muslims slaughter Muslims. I think the greatest war we've seen in the last 20 years is a war between Iran and Iraq. This had nothing to do with Jews and Christians. This is a war between Iraq and Iran, and Saddam Hussein is guilty of starting it, and over a million Muslims were killed by fellow Muslims. And yet Saddam Hussein is not a war criminal. The Slobodan Milosevic kills 2,000 terrorists, he's going to be behind bars the rest of his life. Because the world government, the globalist one world agenda, has decided it already. So Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, Algeria, Sudan, Somalia, this is the type of utopia you can expect from the Dar es Salaam. Is that peace? That's not peace. Islam is not a religion of peace. The next deception takes a little longer to explain, but this is the key to the whole message tonight. Is Allah just another name for God? And I'm going to explain to you now exactly who Allah is. First, let's look at who our God is. The God of the Jew and the God of the Christian is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And this is, by the way, confirmed 7 times in the New Testament. I, as a Jew, almost melted when I saw Jesus saying, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord thy God. Love thy fellow as thyself." These are the two most important commandments for the Jewish people. I used to think that the New Testament was written by a Catholic priest in Sicily. The New Testament is a Jewish book. Jews need to read it. The only problem is when I come to my Jewish brothers and sisters, say, read the New Testament, first thing they say, "Oh, he's a Jew for Jesus now." And I say, no, you've got to read it. It's a Jewish book, and it teaches us about how Christians think, and we need the Christians with us not to be destroyed by the Muslims. And then they say, well, why should we read the New Testament? We don't read the Old Testament. By the way, I do another no-no. I'm a Jewish guy who goes to my fellow Jews in the synagogues and says, "Jews, you need to go to church." So everybody starts pulling their head out of their head. There he goes, Jew for Jesus. I said, I'm not a Jew for Jesus. You got to go to church, because in church, and I go to church, praise God, 6 days a week, and on the 7th day, I'm in synagogue. And I'm not covered. I'm smothered in God's word everywhere I go. It's really a hallelujah. And I listen to the pastor's teaching, and I enjoy myself. I don't agree with every pastor. I don't agree with every rabbi either. And the point I'm saying is, I say, you need to go to church to learn the Bible from a different angle, and you need to go to church to see just exactly how the Christians love us. Because I grew up as a person who was taught that Christians hate us. And every time I leave my hometown in the Northeast, I don't want to say exactly where, and I start driving, because it's on radio, I don't know who's listening now, you know. And I start driving, and I leave the synagogue where I grew up, they say to me, "So why are you going to the Christians? They hate us." This is just 3 months ago. The same people with whom I grew up. "Why are you going to the Christians? They hate us." I said, "You need to go to church." So they said, "Well, why should we go to church? We don't go to synagogue." This is some of the frustration that I deal with in my line of work. So, our God is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. This is repeated 7 times in the New Testament. And let's look a little bit at Abraham. This will take, again, a few minutes. It sounds like a very heavy lecture, but I'll try to do it in a relatively quick time and in a funny way, too, so you'll enjoy it. Abraham is 99 years old. Ishmael is already 12 years old. And the angels of the Lord appear unto Abraham and say to him, "You're going to have another son." So what does he do? He laughs. What does Sarah do? She laughs. So what's his name? Laughter. Isaac means laughter. He laughs. Then, seriously, Abraham says to God, to the angels, he says, "You know, who can believe that a 99-year-old with a 90-year-old wife will have a son? It's enough for me that Ishmael should live," because Ishmael was a good son for Abraham. And the angel of the Lord said, "No, you're going to have another son, and Ishmael will be blessed. He will be the father of many nations, but it is not through Ishmael that your seed will be called. Your seed will be called through Isaac." So this is the first time we see this. Second time, when
Isaac is a little baby or a little boy. Ishmael misbehaves in a sexual way, I would say, sexual abuse. And Sarah banishes Hagar and Ishmael a second time from the house. And Abraham is destroyed. He doesn't want Ishmael to leave. Leave the home. He loves his son. God says, send them away, because it is through Isaac your seed will be called. The third time with the Akedah, with the sacrifice, we see the God saying to Abraham, take your one and only begotten son and sacrifice him on Mount Moriah. The fourth time, Abraham is 147. Sarah has died. Abraham has remarried, and he marries Keturah. He has concubines. He has, I don't want to say dozens of children, but he has lots of children. And there was no Viagra in those days. And God says to him, send them all away. There's only one son that will be with you, and that's Isaac, because it is through Isaac that your seed will be called. So God says four times in the book of Genesis, very clearly, that it is not Ishmael, it is Isaac who is to be chosen. And yet the Islamic religion teaches that Eid al-Adha is the day of the sacrifice of Ishmael. So either one of the books is wrong, or God is a confused God. So of course God is not a confused God, one of the books is wrong, and that's the Quran. If you look at Jacob and Esau, the next generation, Esau was a good son. Isaac loved him, just like Abraham loved Ishmael. But the choice was Jacob. And the reason it says in the New Testament and in the book of Malachi that Esau was hated was because Esau married two Canaanite women. If you remember, the Canaanites had a curse on them from the time of Noah, also because of sexual misbehavior of Canaan regarding his grandfather. And then to patch up with his parents, he married two more women, Basmat and Mahalat, the daughters of Ishmael. And then Esau goes to live with Ishmael. Birds of a feather flock together. Now, I have a question for you. Why did King David not build a temple? Why was Solomon the one who built the temple? Because King David was a man of the sword. He was a warrior. He was a murderer. He had blood on his hands. Solomon made love, not war. So Solomon built a temple. God does not like people who have blood on their hands. God loves the lover. This is a very important point. It makes a point. God had a choice. This was a spiritual choice that God made, to choose Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and not Ishmael and not Esau. Ishmael and Esau were good sons, but they were not spiritually the right ones for this job. And of course, Christians, so I've learned in the churches, view Jesus as a shepherd also. In those days, you had shepherds and farmers on the one side, and you had warriors and brigands on the other side. So this is a spiritual decision by God. By the way, Moses, we're going to get to that in a few moments. Moses was a shepherd to Jethro for 40 years. So, and one last point I wanted to make regarding the genealogy of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Again, the New Testament confirms for me as a Jew the divinity of the genealogy of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The first gospel of Matthew, the first chapter, the first page, the first words. These are the generations of Jesus Christ. And you have 14 generations. And right smack in the middle, what do you see? Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And my point here is, I can't understand Jews, and I can't understand Christians who call themselves Jews and Christians, and yet they support Yasser Arafat or they support Islam over Jewish and Christian causes. Because that's absolute heresy. And I was just in Oakland, near Berkeley in California. Do you know that our former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu went to speak at Berkeley, and he was shouted down, not by the Muslims, by left-wing Jews. These people prefer Arafat. And in the Christian side, you have, unfortunately, the Pope, who goes and prays in a mosque, and he says, we serve the same God. And you have Schuller in California, we serve the same God. And you've got Jews who say it too. And this is the deception I'm going to dispel right now. This has to be dispelled, because if you don't understand the difference between Allah and the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, you can't understand where we're going now. Who is Allah? To understand Allah, you have to understand Muhammad. Muhammad, the prophet of Islam, was a 26-year-old camel driver when he had his first revelation. He heard his first voices. That's what it was, really. And there is a Christian Arab doctor, forgive me, I don't know his name. I've seen the manuscript, but I haven't seen the book came out, I think, in March. This Christian Arab doctor wrote a book about the medical prognosis of Muhammad. And he had something kind of like epilepsy, but worse. It was a neurological condition which caused him to have seizures, where indeed, like epilepsy, he would froth at the mouth, and he would salivate and sweat, and he would have sensation of choking to death, he couldn't breathe. This is exactly what Muhammad had. And also, it causes hallucinations. You hear voices. By the way, how do you say a voice in Greek? D-E-M-O-N. Daemon. And indeed, the word in Arabic is jinns. Like, you know, genie, when you rub the bottle, Aladdin's lamp. And I am the genie of the lamp. I give you 3 requests. That's what it is. It says in the Quran, Muhammad says in the Quran, I listen to the jinns. I listen to the genies. And there are good genies, and there are bad genies. And I don't even know the difference. It says in the Quran. You know why it says that? Because, firstly, it's true. Secondly, because the Quran was written by a rabbi. I'm going to get to that a little later. So, he listens to jinns. He doesn't know who's good and who's bad. And he says, but everything he hears from the jinns, he puts into the Quran. So, is that the word of God? That's the word of the good guys, and that's the word of the bad guys. All mixed in together. And he doesn't know the difference, basically. So, he's 26. He has his first revelation. He's in a cave. He wakes up choking. He can't breathe. And hears a voice. Muhammad Iqra. Muhammad read, or Muhammad recite. And he says, well, I don't know how to read. He was illiterate. The Arabs of those times were illiterate. The Jews and the Christians knew how to read, but the Muslims did not, the pagans of Mecca and Medina. And what should I recite? So the voice says to him, I will tell you what to recite. But he was so scared that he took off, ran away from the cave, came to his wife, and his wife says to him, well, you're a prophet if you heard a voice. So the next day he goes to the Jews and the Christians in Mecca and Medina. And he says to the Jews, first he goes to the Jews and he says, I'm a prophet. I was in a cave. I heard a voice. And you know what? I'm the greatest prophet there ever was. I'm greater even than Moses. Moses was hot stuff for the Jews. Don't forget he was 40. He was Egyptian prince. Then for 40 years he was a shepherd unto Jethro. Then at age 80 he went back to confront Pharaoh. He delivered the Israelites out of bondage. Remember the 10 plagues? These 10 miracles, crossing of the Red Sea, another miracle. And then Moses wandered in the desert for 40 years. You know why we wandered in the desert for 40 years? Because Moses wouldn't stop to ask for directions. Actually, you know, we were not supposed to go to Israel. The Arabs were right. We were supposed to go to Canada. Now, no, really. The problem was that Moses was a stutterer. So the Israelites said to him, oh, Moses, our leader, tell us where we're going. So he wanted to say Canada, but he's saying Canaan. So he went to Canaan. And so Moses was 120 years old when he died on Mount Nebo and when he did not cross into the land with the rest of the Israelites. But 120 years of life, 120 years of service to God and to the people. And here comes a 26-year-old barefoot, illiterate nomad. And I don't mean it disrespectfully. He was just a young guy. He heard a voice, and he really believed that he heard a voice. And he comes to the Jews and says he's greater than anything the Jews had. So the Jews, you know where they sent him. So he goes to the Christians, and he says, I heard a voice. I'm a prophet. I'm greater than Jesus Christ. 26-year-old barefoot, illiterate nomad. Jesus, you know, for the Jews even, was a rabbi. He was an ordained authority. He was a prophet. So here comes an illiterate 26-year-old. So anyway, they sent him away also. He had one group left to minister to. These were the pagans of Mecca and Medina. And they had 360 pagan gods, one for every day of the year. And by the way, the 3 most important gods out of the 360 were the moon, the sun, and the stars. When you look at the flags of Islam, you see the moon, the sun, and the stars. What does it say in Deuteronomy? Deuteronomy is a book holy to Christians as well as the Jews. In Deuteronomy, it says anybody who worships the moon, the sun, and the stars gets a capital death sentence. That's what it says in the Bible of the Jew and the Christian. So he abolished first 357, leaving the moon, the sun, and the stars. And then eventually he got rid of the sun and the stars. By the way, the moon was the father, the sun was the mother, and the 3 stars were the daughters of this conjugal relationship, according to the pagan mythology of Mecca and Medina. He said, this is passé. The Jews and the Christians are right. They are monotheists. We must create for ourselves a monotheistic God. And what we will do is, we will take the greatest of all of these 360 pagan gods, Ilahi. Ilahi means moon crescent. And we will make Ilahi our Allah. Allah was the generic name for God, monotheistic God. And so they realized that the 360 pagan gods were passé, and so he created this new god. He crowned this greatest of all the pagan gods, Ilahi, as Allah, and this is where Allah came from. Now, is Islam a monotheistic religion now? Yes, it is a monotheistic religion. Just like Judaism and Christianity are monotheistic religions. But is Allah God? No. Let's look, for example, at Greek mythology. It's like if you took Zeus. You know, Zeus is the greatest of the Greek pagan gods. And you abolish all the other gods, and you crown Zeus as your monotheistic god. Do you have a monotheistic religion? Yes. But is Zeus the god of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? No. It's still a pagan god. Allah is the god of Islam. Islam is a monotheistic religion, but Allah still remains the moon god, the war god, the sword god, a pagan god. Am I clear? Jews and Christians don't know that. Everybody says, oh, that's just another name for God. Now, how many people here have heard in the mosque the call to prayer? They yell out, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar. And you hear that in Israel a lot. Wherever the Jewish neighborhoods are, they put a mosque right next door so we could hear it. Now, CNN translates that as God is great. Now, isn't that wonderful that God is great? Don't we all know that God is great? My only problem is that if CNN says God is great, I say something wrong here. Now, anybody who knows, does anyone here know Arabic? The word for, yes, how do you say great in Arabic? Kabir. They should say Allah Kabir. If they say Allah Akbar, Akbar means greater or greatest. Now, greatest, I have no problem. Allah is the greatest of 360 pagan gods of Mecca and Medina, gods with a small g. Because that's a statement of historical fact. But the moment they say Allah is greater than whom? Who rejected Muhammad? The Jews and the Christians rejected Muhammad. What does it say in the Quran, Surah 5, verse 51? Believers, Muslims, take neither the Jews nor the Christians for your friends, period. The Jews and the Christians are friends with one another, period. Anyone who befriends them will become one of their number, period. Allah doesn't guide the wrongdoer. It is a wrongdoing to befriend a Jew or a Christian in the Islamic religion. Any Muslim who says he's your friend is either lying to you or lying to Allah. Because the commandment is very clear. It's black on white. Believers, Muslims, take neither the Jews nor the Christians as your friends. We are the Dar el-Kitab. The Jews and the Christians together are one people. We are the people of the book in the eyes of Islam. So when they're saying Allah is the greatest, that's okay. But when they say Allah is greater, there's a problem. Allah is greater than the God of the Jews. Who's the God of the Jews? God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Who's the God of Islam? Allah. So who said he was greater than God before his fall? Satan, Lucifer. Allahu Akbar, Allah is greater than the God of the Jew and the Christian. So what I'm saying is, and this is dangerous for me to do this. This is not a very healthy business I'm in, to say that Allah is Satan. Okay, so Allah is Satan. Allah is a war god, a sword god, a moon god. The patriarch of Islam is Ishmael. What do we know about Ishmael? Let's look at Ishmael. If you don't understand these basic points, you can't understand why they blow up the USS Cole. You can't understand why they blow up your embassies. You can't understand why Oklahoma City was an Islamic bomb, why TW-800 was an Islamic missile, and all these cover-ups going on. We're going to get into this, hopefully, in the next 3 or 4 hours. You know, I think one of the greatest verses in the Bible, one of the greatest and most tragic fulfillments of Bible prophecy is when the angel of God appears before Hagar, and he says to her, you're going to have a son, his name is going to be Ishmael. He will be the father of many nations. He will be a great man. But he will be, it says in Hebrew, a pere adam. Pere means, anyone know Spanish here? Burro. He will be a donkey. He will be a mule. He will be kicking in all directions. His hand will be against all his brother's hands, and all his brother's hands will be against his hand, and he will dwell in the face of his brethren. What does that mean? It means he will be fighting. You know, in American slang, hey man, you're in my face. You better get out of my face. That means war. Ishmael is a warrior. And a few chapters later, when he dies, it says, and he died in the face of his brethren, meaning Ishmael died fighting. And again, I can't repeat enough. Look at the bottom line today in the 21st century. Look at the countries of Islam. Look at the wars that are taking place nonstop. First, they fight the pagans, the Buddhists, the Hindus, the blacks, the jungle people. And the Jews and the Christians come later. We're going to get to that now. So Ishmael is blessed as a man of the sword. So you have a sword god. By the way, in Arabic, the word is din asif. It's the law of the sword in Islam. So you have a moon god, war god, sword god. You have a war patriarch, Ishmael. You have a war Rasulullah. You have the messenger of Allah. He's a war prophet. And the role model, I'm going to get to this in a few moments too, is Saladin. Salah ad-Din. Saladin is the greatest role model for every Islamic young man. I'm going to tell you something in a few moments. You're going to hold your head when we get to the part about Israel.
For a complete listing of materials to further enhance your personal Bible study, or to receive a free one-year subscription to Chuck Missler's monthly Christian Intelligence News Journal, Personal Update, contact Koinonia House at 1-800-KHOUSE1. That's 1-800-KHOUSE1. Or you can write to Koinonia House at P.O. Box D, Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, 83816-0347. To fax your correspondence, dial 208-773-6312.